The following podcast is a production of the Washington College of Law at American University. Any unauthorized use or distribution is strictly prohibited.
Well, good morning to all of you. I am very happy to welcome you to the third symposium on national emerging issues in national and international security. And I don't know why we're getting an intimate atmosphere in here, but it'll make it that much more meaningful, whatever you hear. My name is Cal McClanahan. I am the international president of NSLS and one of the co-founders of this chapter here at WCL. It's a great pleasure to have hosted Eminent for the last 3 years, and this is actually our last year that we are guaranteed to be hosting it here, and it's my last year to have a role in hosting it because I graduate in May. But Eminent is something that really speaks to what NSLS is. We are very thrilled that so many professionals can come here and so many students can come here to sit next to each other and to hear from panelists, and the panelists can learn from each other and the professionals can learn from each other. And most importantly to us, the students can learn from all of the above. Because in the end, whether you're a student, professional, speaker, cabinet member, what have you, NSLS is a student organization. And this is all about fostering awareness in law schools. It used to be across the country, now across the world, now that we have chapters cropping up in Canada and Israel and South Korea. And so I just have to say, as sort of a person who has seen this from its beginning, and when we were fighting to have a panel with three people on it and 30 people in the audience, people paying to come here is astounding. That being said, there's really nothing else I can say. You didn't come here to hear me talk. I will point out a little administrative note. If you're getting CLE credit, you have to turn in your paperwork before you leave. That's one of the rules. If you don't, they come yell at me, and I'm not happy, and I don't pass the bar. That being said, I hope you enjoy this panel. I hope you enjoy all four panels. I hope you can make it to the luncheon. We have wonderful food, and we have a wonderful speaker up from Texas with a very distinguished career. And without further ado, I'll introduce our first moderator, Professor Dan Marcus. He's a professor of constitutional law here at WCL and former General Counsel for 9/11 Commission, among many other very distinguished things that he's done in his career. So, Professor Marcus.
Thanks. Welcome. On December 16th, was it December 16th, Eric? On December 16th, 2005, we opened our morning New York Times to the stunning news in a story by one of our speakers today, that for 4 years, the National Security Agency, at President Bush's direction, had been operating a secret program of interception and surveillance of international communications between people in the United States and people abroad who were suspected of connections to Al-Qaeda, without any review or approval by the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Court under the longstanding statute electronic surveillance in the United States for foreign intelligence purposes. As you recall, this led to a legal and political firestorm. The administration admitted that it was operating this program without complying with the FISA statute. It argued that the program was nevertheless authorized by the resolution of Congress approving the use of force against those responsible for 9/11. And if it wasn't authorized by that resolution, the president nonetheless had the constitutional authority under Article 2 of the Constitution as commander-in-chief to conduct the program. Lawsuits were filed challenging the legality of the program, and bills were introduced in Congress to limit the program or authorize it and bring it under the FISA statute. After the Hamdan decision last June on the military commissions, the administration did finally seek legislation to authorize the program. In the meantime, one district judge out in Detroit held that the program was unlawful and unconstitutional on every conceivable ground. A couple of months ago, however, after the 2006 election, I'm not suggesting a causal relationship, the administration stunned us again. It announced that, lo and behold, it had found a way to bring the NSA program under FISA, and indeed had gotten a FISA court order approving surveillance under the program. It's my understanding that the FISA application that was filed by the Justice Department and the court order approving surveillance under the NSA program as modified has been made available. Those have been made available to the Senate and House Intelligence Committees, and I think to the chairman and ranking members of the Judiciary Committees, but not to the public. The challenges to the legality of the original NSA program continue, and they may not be moot. We are still left with the questions as to the need for the program, as a matter of national security, and whether the recent changes in the program are sufficient to eliminate the policy and legal objections to the program. We have a very distinguished panel here today to discuss these issues, and I'll introduce all the speakers now in the order in which they're going to speak. Our first speaker will be Eric Lischblau, a reporter for the New York Times, who was the author or co-author of the December 16, 2005 article, and has covered these issues and lots of related issues on the war on terror and the Justice Department for the New York Times. He's currently finishing a book on the Bush Justice Department. Our second speaker will be James Carafano, who is an assistant director, is that the title? Lots of things that follow. I said to him, for national security, foreign policy, and the world, or something like that, at the Heritage Foundation. Dr. Carafano is the author of a lot of works in this area and is well qualified to talk to us about the national security rationale for this program and the issues that it raises. Our final speaker will be David Criss, who's currently Vice President and Deputy General Counsel of Time Warner. But the reason he's here today is because of his former incarnation. He spent many years at the Justice Department and was the Associate Deputy Attorney General in charge of national security matters in both at the end of the Clinton administration and at the beginning of the Bush administration through September 11th. He is the world, I say this without fear of contradiction, the world's great expert on FISA, and is also finishing a book, or has finished a book, which will soon be published, on the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act. Okay, first we're going to hear from Mr. Lischblau.
Thank you, Dan. Well, Professor Marcus has given you a pretty thorough overview of where the NSA story has gone from December 2005 through today, so I won't bother kind of rehashing all the key points there. I guess the one additional point that I would make there is that the Detroit decision that Dan mentioned, ruling that the program was illegal and unconstitutional, is now under review by the on appeal before the Sixth Circuit, and we expect a decision on that any time, which should be, you know, either way it goes, will be a fascinating and somewhat historic decision that will almost certainly be appealed to the Supreme Court. So I think the hope from many players in this is that we'll get some. Can you hear me? Oh, is that better?
Yeah,
that's right. All right. Could you hear what I was saying, or should I go back and Anyway, the Sixth Circuit is supposed to rule on this almost any time now, and that decision will almost certainly go to the Supreme Court, and we may finally have some a bit of clarity and finality on really the overarching question here, which is whether or not the President has the constitutional powers, as Bush and his people have asserted, to act outside FISA in his role as Commander-in-Chief. I mean, that is the crux of the argument. As Dan mentioned, there was a sort of a corollary argument that the administration made, which, to be honest, and with all due respect, was laughed off by pretty much everyone who heard it, which was that the authorization to use military force that Congress had passed just days after September 11th and was seen by most members of Congress as authorizing the use of force against al-Qaeda, principally in Afghanistan, that also somehow authorized the President to do wiretapping and conduct eavesdropping operations on American soil. They've really backed off that argument because that was so widely panned by just about everyone, including Republican members of Congress, who said that was certainly never our intention. We wanted you to go after al-Qaeda in Afghanistan, not to eavesdrop on Americans on U.S. soil. So the core question really has come back to, does the President have the constitutional power, even in the even with the existence of a law in the books like FISA, to, on his own authority, order wiretapping electronic surveillance on American citizens? And that's obviously the central question in this entire debate. I'll give you a little bit of the background as to how we came to the story. There are limits, obviously, as to what I can say, in case there are FBI agents in the audience who were working on the leak investigation of this. I'm not going to get into details, obviously. But, I think it's worth pointing out the context as to how all this came about. I cover principally the Justice Department for the Times and our Washington Bureau, and I've been covering the whole debate over the Patriot Act for the better part of 4 years. The Patriot Act, as you probably remember, was passed just 5 weeks after 9/11. There was a real rush by the administration to get them the tools that they said they needed to respond to 9/11. They dusted off proposals that had been in the works long before Bush took office, going back to the Clinton administration, for updating technological methods, roving wiretaps, for broadening the use of terrorist financing tools. It's a 350-page bill, which is basically sort of every tool in the toolbox put into one piece of legislation. So I have been covering the ins and outs of this debate for most of 4 years, really. And what was fascinating about the NSA story is that while we were all focused on what were really kind of, in the scheme of things, minutiae and arcane details about whether or not, the original Patriot Act changed, as David could tell you better than I can, changed the purpose for getting a FISA warrant for wiretapping from being the primary purpose to the significant purpose. There were other debates over whether or not business records had to be sought in connection to an investigation or relevant to, and what was a higher standard, and was this close to probable cause, was this reasonable suspicion, and all sorts of things that probably only Dan and David and three other people in the world could even tell you the difference between. And we were really sort of looking at these incredibly narrow issues when, in fact, there was this whole shadow operation going on, which was the 800-pound gorilla in the room. I'll leave it to others whether or not that was intentional or not on the part of the administration. But I think the effect was that for the better part of 4 years, we all thought we had a general understanding as to how these counterterrorism operations worked. And even given the limited amount that we did know, there was this furious debate about the limits of presidential authority and the effectiveness and legality of certain counterterrorism tools through the Patriot Act, through other mechanisms, when in fact there was this entire other shadow operation which no one knew about, which went so far beyond anything that we were publicly debating. As we've come to find out, there were significant debates even within the administration about the operations of this program, the controls, the potential for abuses, and not inconsequentially the legality of this, and whether or not the President had overstepped his authority. Of course, the administration has maintained that this was is well within the president's legal purview. We've had, as Dan said, we've had a number of lawsuits brought against the telecommunications companies, brought against the government itself. The case in Detroit has gone the furthest, but there are others in, that are consolidated out in San Francisco, civil suits that are also progressing. So we don't know at this point how it's all played out. And the other big thing we don't know is really the operations of the program. We know a fair amount about what was actually done for the first 4 years, but without a real congressional investigation into the inner workings of this program, there are still numerous questions that we don't have answers to. Exactly how many people were eavesdropped on? Were they real suspects? Were there abuses? Were in fact purely domestic calls listened to? There are not answers to any of those questions right now, and unless Congress pushes more than they have so far, we'll probably never know the answers to those questions. So.
Okay, Jim. All right. What I normally do with my students at Georgetown National Defense University, teach them at Homeland Security, is to just teach you how to frame questions. How do you know what good is? How do you know what the government should be doing? Let me make just three quick points, all of which I think. Kind of overarch the issue of this specific program. And the first is, how do you win a long war? Which is, I think, one of the, if you want to call it a war, not because we have a whole debate on that, but I mean, I think one of the remarkable things is that there's one thing that most people in Washington agree on, right, left, conservative, liberal, is nobody thinks that dealing with transnational terrorism is a quick operation that's going to be done by the 6 o'clock news or a year or 2 years or 3 years. I mean, there seems to be a broad consensus that this is a protracted competition between the United States and transnational terrorist groups. And that's important because you fight long wars differently. I'm a military historian. There's been lots of long wars in history. And traditionally what happens in a long war is as wars protract, as they lengthen, the actors, whether empires or states or non-state actors, become more desperate. And what they tend to do is they tend to try to generate power. They think, if I can just maximize power, I can win this thing. And so they tend to become more authoritarian, pull power to the center, centralize decision-making, depress civil liberties, increase taxation, on the notion of trying to create enough power to win. And the irony is, as they do that, what they actually do is tend to become less competitive and less powerful. And that's why most long wars typically devolve into wars of attrition. There are very few exceptions to that. One of the most remarkable was the United States and its allies during the Cold War, where the United States and the allies come out the other end not only victorious, but arguably more powerful, just as free, constitution still in place. And it's a pretty remarkable achievement. And so I think one of the lessons of that is one of the keys to good long war strategy is in winning a long war, it's important to maintain the competitive power of the state to compete over time. It's like running a marathon. When you don't know what's going to end, you win when the other guy quits. So as much as getting the enemy, and you have to do both things equally well. And what I've argued before is there's really four elements to good long war strategy: security, which includes both, you know, getting the bad guys and protecting yourself against them; economic growth, which not only pays for the security but pays for all the other needs of the society; protection of civil liberties and privacy, because what allows an actor to compete best over the long term is the consent of the governed. And the civil liberties are really the glue that pulls all that together. And winning the war of ideas, because all wars are essentially won in the minds of men and women, and particularly long wars where it's not going to end in some big parade or a climactic battle, that you have to win an ideological struggle. And the argument that I've made before, we did this book called Winning the Long War, is that And the key to victory in the Cold War is you have to do all four things equally well. You cannot trade one off for the other. You can't, for example, argue that, well, I can give you more security, but to do that, I'll have to decrement your civil liberties, because in the end, that's self-defeating, because you're undercutting one of the strengths of the things that allows you best to compete over the long term. So the argument that I've made before is that any policy that you propose, whether it's how to inspect containers or whatever, that you have to ask four questions. Will it help you get terrorists? Does it allow the economy to grow and remain competitive? Does it protect the civil liberties of Americans, respect those of our allies, and foster human rights for all? And does it help win the war of ideas? And if the answer is yes, then you've got a bad program. Scrap it and start over and give me one better. And we did this during the Cold War, and so we waxed and waned, but we generally kept to that strategy. We could certainly do it in the War on Terror. So I think that's the fundamental framework that I do look at all policy and program decisions. And that's the strategy. And then the question, well, okay, strategy's fine, but then what are the tactics? What are they specifically going to do? And the irony here is, I think, is in really defeating transnational terrorism. The irony is that the tactics we used before 9/11 are really the most effective. Now, nobody likes to hear that because we have this terrorist attack. So everybody thinks that, you know, we have to do something wildly different or dramatically completely different than we did before 9/11. And the truth is, the most effective way to stop terrorists is to stop them before they attack. It's every buck you spend on offense is worth $10 on defense. We live in a country of infinite vulnerabilities, and if you want to, and I'm not a math major, but if you spend $20 billion taking one vulnerability off the table, you've got infinity minus one. I think that the problem before 9/11 is we just didn't do enough of it, and we didn't do it effectively enough. But the most effective counterterrorism tools are investigation and interdiction. The problem, I think, is not willing to accept that on both the right and the left. On the one side, I think we have three instruments, covert operations, intelligence gathering, military operations, and law enforcement. And I think on the one hand, there are people that want to blur those together because they say, hey, the enemy operates across these boundaries. And I think the lesson learned is, the enemy may operate across these boundaries, but it's very problematic for the United States to do that. And really, we should remain, as we did before 9/11, focusing in military operations within their province and domain, and intelligence within this, and law enforcement within there, and just making sure those things are connected well. On the other side, there's a tendency not to want to go there, because intelligence interdiction involves going after people, and that creates all kinds of problems. And so there's this tendency to want to shy away from that and focus on things which make great bumper stickers, really very esoteric. So, for example, on the other side, you hear a lot of focus on, well, let's inspect containers. Well, containers don't have civil rights. They don't take you to court. It's an easy thing to look after. Now, it's a very peripheral threat. It's an enormous amount of money. It's a very ineffective technique. But it shows action. So there's willingness to spend billions of dollars on that to inconvenience everybody and to, you know, cost everybody as long as we don't offend anybody. So I think the problem is I think, in a sense, a failure to recognize that good counterterrorism operations after 9/11 are, quite frankly, the same as good counterterrorism operations were before 9/11. And it's a people-focused. It's on human terrain. And you have to go where humans are and deal where humans are, because that's going out and finding conspiracies, breaking them up, identifying bad people and interdicting the way out is the most cost-effective and the best way to do that. And I'll just end to my third point, which is I think the debate over tactics has been unhelpful and has really made it difficult, in a sense, to implement the strategy, because when you have a program and you say, we need to do surveillance, the debate automatically becomes between security and liberty. That if I'm adding security, I'm decrementing liberty, and it's framed as an either-or decision, which I think is, quite frankly, false and unhelpful. The debate should be, okay, if we need to do this, how can we do this to better get terrorists and protect our civil liberties and privacies? And there's a thing that some people are calling lawfare, which I think is a real way to try to constrain American power or constrain the executive, which is this notion of taking issues which are either clearly not legal debates and really policy debates, or if they are legal debates, they're highly disputable legal debates between two parties as which is right and which is wrong, and framing it as this is clearly a violation of the wrong, and this is clearly something you shouldn't be doing. And this has been used for everything from the Patriot Act to Guantanamo Bay and really across the spectrum of debates. And quite frankly, it's unhelpful, because what it does is you're obscuring with political rhetoric, which either are policy choices, or at least highly contentious legal issues that quite frankly, will have to be settled in court. And so I think, as I was looking, I would be looking at this issue as any of the issues that we're debating over is what appropriate things. I think all three of those things, I think, should be front and center. It has to go back to a strategy. And the strategy has to balance, not balance is the wrong word, it has to equally serve security, economic growth, civil liberties, and the ideological competition. You have to get over this notion that you have to realize that the tactics have to go where the people are, and you're going to have to operate on human terrain. You cannot not
look at people's conversations and activities and do effective interdiction and investigations. And then the third thing is I think we need to parse very carefully when we're having political debates and when we're having legal debates and make those very clear and obvious and not do the opposite, which is obfuscate that, because that doesn't help to make good public policy. Thanks.
Dave?
Okay. I have no idea what I'm going to say to you, so we'll just see what comes out. To me, I think in this forum, it's interesting to think about the controversy over the NSA surveillance program, or the terrorist surveillance program, as the administration calls it, as a case study in the way our government works, and to contrast it with another case study involving the so-called FISA wall that Professor Marcus mentioned earlier. These are, in my view at least, the two most significant changes in the law, policy, and operational reality post 9/11. And yet they present very different, I think, perspectives and lessons about the way our government actually handles these kinds of issues in real life. And by real life, I mean sort of the intersection of law, both abstract and as applied, politics, obviously, the media. I mean, there would be no discussion about the NSA surveillance program, I think, were it not for Eric, and that may be a good or bad thing. And, you know, the reality of how you handle national security issues and the need to protect classified sources and methods in a democracy that sort of functions on open and notorious debate of public policy issues. This is a law school. Some of you at least are law students. I'm a lawyer, so I'll probably lay a little bit of a thumb on the scale in favor of law. I think you risk devolving into an exchange of platitudes if you talk about something like this in a legal context without having some kind of grounding in the nuts and bolts law. I'm in favor of security. I'm in favor of liberty. So what? But it's very hard to drill down into the sort of weeds of the legal regime. I'll try to give you sort of an overview of how I think this thing played out and how I think about it in the larger scheme, and then if time permits and your pain tolerance permits, I'm happy to sort of go over some of the technical legal issues that really inform and frame what I think is the legal and policy debate, okay? So, I don't know. Here we go. The way this NSA surveillance program played out is sort of instructive, right? It was a quick decision, apparently, by the president to start doing this shortly, very shortly after September 11th. And they decided, apparently, to not go to the FISA court and instead take it up on the president's own initiative and start surveilling. Very few people knew about this. I was not read into this program. That's why I feel free to talk about it. And that apparently put some pressure on the system. And eventually, the result was, I guess, people started talking to Eric. Executive branch employees, I can tell you from experience, like to believe that what they're doing, by and large, is good and true and beautiful and authorized by law. And I don't know what motivated these people to leak possibly classified information to Eric, but I would not be surprised if it was a feeling that, you know, something isn't right here. They may have been right and they may have been wrong. I don't want to comment on that, but, you know, the system that we had with FISA was one that sort of gave some comfort, not just to citizens at large, but to executive branch employees. Then you get, you know, the fear of disclosures. You get lots of discussion in Congress. You have Senator Specter introducing bills and others introducing bills that will change the law, either to regulate this or forbid it or authorize it or whatever. Then you have, of course, the elections. We have those every couple of years. And now you have the program some years after it initiated being brought under the rubric of FISA and being submitted to the FISA court. The government announced in January that all activity previously conducted under this terrorist surveillance program would now be brought under the FISA court's jurisdiction and conducted only pursuant to court orders. They haven't said they have to do that. They've just said that they decided to do it on their own initiative. But the decision to do it obviously took place in a larger reality that includes the results of the midterm elections. Contrast that with the other big change in the post-9/11 law of electronic surveillance, the FISA wall. The FISA wall, for those who don't know, was a sort of a set of understandings and rules and cultural expectations that separated intelligence operatives from their law enforcement counterparts and prevented them from working together cooperatively in a meaningful way. And I believe it certainly had its roots in a legal interpretation of FISA, but there were cultural pieces to that as well. The way the government proceeded there, and on this part of it I was very involved, so take what I say with a grain of salt, was to get the Patriot Act enacted, to go to the FISA court, to argue to the FISA court that the law had changed and that this wall could come down. I presented the government's argument to the FISA court, and I must say that even in hindsight, I am astonished by how spectacularly ineffective I was in advancing that argument. I lost, I guess it was 11 to nothing. Well, these things happen. So what did we do then? We proceeded in a sort of more traditional legal course. We got a better lawyer. And Ted Olson, the Solicitor General of the United States, argued the case in the FISA Court of Review, the appellate court. He was much more effective, and there's a published decision that testifies to that effectiveness, which I commend.
You told him what to say.
Yeah, right. I was sitting right next to him, and I was saying, go, Ted, go. it really does tell you, for those of you in the audience who are law students, it does, in fact, matter who you get as your lawyer. It can make the difference between what you call winning and what you call losing. And it seems to me, and again I may be a biased observer, that controversy over the demise of the FISA wall has largely faded away. Nobody really is that upset about it anymore. Even the sort of staunch civil libertarians, the ACLU and its that sort of perspective, I really don't think that it's such a good idea to have this wall up. And I think, by and large, that controversy has died away. So that's the upside. And indeed, there are now major structural changes taking place in the government that are possible only because the wall is down. And one of them, the chief among them, is the creation of the National Security Division at DOJ, which combines the intelligence lawyers and the prosecutors together in one subunit. That could never have been done before the wall came down. The upside of all of that, and that sort of legalistic step-by-step slow and steady approach, is that the end result, I think, is pretty enduring, I think. The downside is the wall didn't even come down legally for over a year. So for 13 months or 14 months, whatever, the government labored under the wall even after the Patriot Act had been enacted. And I think the reciprocal values apply to the NSA program. On the one hand, they were quick out of the box. Unilateral executive action is quick. But the downside is that when it leaked some years later, it blew up in a pretty major way. There were all kinds of political fallout. And the controversy continues, and I think the fact that they have now brought it to the FISA court in the end has not necessarily ended the controversy. So, you know, there are pluses and minuses to both approaches, but I do think if you take a look at these two things side by side, you do get a lesson in, you know, the beauty and the ugliness of how the American system of government tackles these kinds of difficult public policy and legal questions. And I think I should stop there.
Okay, we're going to take some questions from the audience, but before we do that, I'm going to exercise my moderator's prerogative to sound off a little and to ask our panelists some questions. Let me just make a couple of comments on the still pending litigation. I wouldn't be quite as optimistic as Eric is that we're going to get a decision on the merits of this program from either the Court of Appeals or the Supreme Court. While I think the Sixth Circuit was pretty unreceptive, maybe, to the argument that the case was moot, the government also has a standing argument that the plaintiffs in this case who allege that their ability to communicate with their sources in Afghanistan and other places has been effectively chilled by the existence of this program, whether that's sufficient concrete injury to get a court to rule on it is somewhat doubtful. In addition, the government has this state secrets argument, which I think was, my personal view is one of the reasons that, aside from the election, that the government, that the administration decided to bring this program under FISA if it could, was the concern that the state secrets argument wouldn't be successful in this case. But we'll see. We still may get some important court decisions here, but I wouldn't be so sure. I do think, by the way, that David's contrast between the way the wall issue was handled and the way the NSA surveillance issue was handled is instructive. I think in a number of areas, the administration's very aggressive assertion of executive authority, as in this case, and in this case combined with secrecy, conducting this major program outside the scope of FISA for 4 years, I guess, without any real consultation with Congress, that a price is paid for that. And one of the prices is, as David indicated, this controversy isn't over. You would think once the administration announced that it had decided to recast this program or to maybe not change it at all, but to bring it under FISA, and that it had persuaded the FISA court, made up of these 11 or however many there are now, federal district judges, basically to approve the program under FISA, you'd think that the controversy would die down somewhat. It has died down somewhat, I think, but it still rages because the secrecy with which this program was surrounded and the failure of the administration to get authorization from Congress at the very time it was going to Congress for changes, other changes in the FISA law to fight terrorism, has created a suspicion that there may still be problems with the program, and it's going to be hard to end those suspicions. The other thing that I think I'd like the panelists to comment on, sort of several things. One, Dr. Carafano, I think you, in your brief remarks, you really, perhaps only implicitly, reached a conclusion as to what you think of the NSA program evaluated according to the criteria that you laid out. I take it from what you said that you think that the goal of this program, that is, finding out what people in the United States are saying to people abroad who are connected to, or there's a reasonable basis to think are connected to Al-Qaeda, is a very important and legitimate goal. But then how do you move from that to a conclusion as to whether this particular program adequately took account of the other considerations that you say need to be taken into account, including civil liberties, the law, and public confidence in the program. One thing I'd like to throw out for all of you to talk about that is suggested by David Criss's comparison of the two programs and the need for quick action after 9/11, which I think we're all agreed on. Is there an argument that, as, and I'm not talking just law here, but politics, public policy in a larger sense, is there an argument that the president was justified on an emergency basis after 9/11 in instituting this program for some brief period. After all, it's hard to remember now, but on September 12th and September 13th, we were worried, the United States and the government of the United States was worried that the 9/11 attacks might simply have been step one in a series of coordinated attacks against the United States. Was the president justified in intercepting and surveilling phone calls between the United States and Afghanistan in the weeks following 9/11 without going through the FISA process, but should he have then gone to Congress, either gone to Congress for authorization of this program or brought the program promptly into compliance with the statute at that point, regardless of what he believed as to the scope of his authority as Commander-in-Chief. Well, the final thing I'd like you all to talk about a little is sort of what you think, to the extent you are willing to speculate, what you think about the what is the how was this program brought under FISA, to the extent that you can speculate? What is it that led the FISA court to be willing to approve this program? And where do we go from here? What do you think is likely to happen on Capitol Hill? I won't ask you to predict what's likely to happen in the lawsuits. Is this issue gradually fading away? Is there going to be real scrutiny of the current program by the House and Senate Intelligence Committees or the Judiciary Committees, and so on? Okay, why don't you go first, Jim?
Well, you know, certainly as a tactic, trying to intercept the communication between a belligerent overseas and someone in the United States, potentially a U.S. person, is nothing new. I mean, that goes back even before we had U.S. persons, back to the American Revolution. So certainly that as a tactic is kind of almost time-honored. How this program fits in, I think, actually goes to the nub of the whole discussion about the long war. You know, there are two arguments against calling this a war. One of them is incredibly stupid and silly, which is it's not a real war. You know, you can't have a war against a tactic. Well, the Cold War was a what? It was a war against cold. I mean, it was cold and hot. I mean, wars are cultural. The discussion and naming of wars are cultural terms that are very cultural laden, which are not very legalistic in any way, shape, or form. So those kinds of debates are really kind of silly and academic and arid and really have no place. The second argument against calling it a war is actually much, much more important and extremely germane, and that is, well, in wars, countries and the executives of those countries have extraordinary powers to protect the state. I don't think anybody disputes that. Well, if you say it's a long war, it's a protracted conflict, that means that the executive or that is going to be exercising this power for a long time, and that's troubling. Because we all know that the more power is used, the more potential there is for abuse. So the notion that an executive or even a nation in its own self-defense would use extraordinary powers over a long period of time is deeply troubling. And I think that's actually a very valid, important concern. Now, of course, not calling the war doesn't solve any of that. You still have that problem because the executive still has the responsibility to protect the nation. And that's why I think where this program comes in is even if we have a dispute, even if the president had perfect legal authority, undisputed, to do this program, now, I would have argued that he should not do that over the long term. Because potentially, the longer you do that, you exercise this executive privilege, the longer the potential is there for abuse. And so in order to do both, which I don't think is a trivial point, liberty for liberty and for security, because there are lots of people who aren't. There are lots of people who are for liberty and perfectly willing to sacrifice security. And there are lots of people who are doing anything for security and are perfectly willing to take away their constitutional rights. So I don't think it's a trivial point at all to say that you're for both. What I would have argued is that if it is a long war, then the executive has as a good strategist has should be self-constraining, even where he may necessarily not have a legal requirement to constrain his executive power. He should, if he can, because in order to maintain the health of the civil society. So I would have argued from the outset that if this, that this program should have been brought under FISA, we made several recommendations on how to do that. Of course, I'm pleased that it now is. Now, I mean, retrospectively, there's a question of was there a compelling need to do this? Could this have been done sooner? Was there a compelling need to do this? Were there actual security risks out there that justified that? And I think the point is you know, we're all just kind of arguing around the circle, because unless you have all the facts laid before you, of course, you can't really make those determinations. But the other thing I did want to mention before we move to this point is we actually had a very good debate at this at Heritage with John Yu from Irvine and Mary Del Rosso from CSIS and a couple other people, and really had both sides of the debate and really had a good thing on that. And we archived it on our website, so if you're really interested in this debate and want to see a really good debate on this, it's, if you just go to www.heritage.org and then go to the events and then go to the archives, it's a couple of, I think a month or so old, but it was a really, really, I thought, very fruitful debate, and I'd commend it to you.
I guess I'll start with your last question about where the program is now, and the bottom line is that we really still don't know. As Dan said, the administration has briefed, has given classified briefings to the Intelligence Committee and has provided some materials to the heads of the Judiciary Committee, but we're in this unusual situation where the framework is still a mystery for how this program now operates, and a lot of this gets back to the intense secrecy of the administration, the invocation of state secrets, privileges with these lawsuits. There is a feeling, I think unnecessarily so in the view of a lot of people, that even discussing the parameters of this program would somehow, some way, compromise national security. So people are left to guess and speculate as to how this program will now work. We had a law in 1978 under FISA that laid out very clearly and very publicly how foreign intelligence should be collected. Now it's sort of a guessing game as to how the system works. Our best sense, and I'd be interested in David's perspective on this too, is that what we have now that the court has agreed to is some sort of a hybrid between the pre-NSA program, where you, in effect, had individualized warrants. If they wanted to listen to me or to David or to Dan or to anyone in this room, they would have to lay out probable cause for why they believe that person was an agent of a foreign power. The terrorist surveillance program, as the administration calls it, was this broad operation using complicated algorithms from the NSA to identify communication patterns, using pattern analysis to say a universe of people who might be in communication overseas with Al-Qaeda. Now, we do not believe, based on what's come out publicly, that the FISA court simply rubber-stamped and said, you can do what you were doing before in secret for the last 5 years. We'll let you do that, and anyone who's caught in these crosshairs, you can listen to. Our best sense is that it's something of a hybrid between that, on the one hand, an individualized warrant to lay out reason why we believe this person might be an agent of foreign power, and this huge program authority, somewhere in between there. But it's really just guesswork as to exactly what that means in practice.
I'm agnostic on the ultimate validity of the NSA surveillance program in its pre-FISA court form. I think the government's statutory arguments are well made and very smart, but I'm not persuaded by them. I don't think I'm sort of quite of the same level of skepticism as Eric is about their validity, but I will grant that they have not fared well, the statutory arguments, in the sort of marketplace of ideas. Assuming those arguments are invalid, I think the constitutional question is impossible, at least for me, to answer without knowing the facts, both as a matter of separation of powers, because FISA includes a provision that says basically to the president, if you're going to do electronic surveillance for foreign intelligence purposes, you must do it under FISA's procedures or not at all. That, I think, raises a very, if you assume that that means what it says, and if you therefore reject the government's statutory arguments, which, as I say, are, I think, substantial but not persuasive, at least to me, you are left with the question, can Congress restrict the president in that way? And that's a big, you know, serious. A lot of people can get tenure writing about that. I mean, it's a big question. It's big, hard question. I don't know the answer to it. You'd need to know the facts, it seems to me, to know, unless you sort of have a very potent theory of constitutional law one way or the other. And I think there's a hard Fourth Amendment question as well, which is also difficult to answer without the facts. I do think that the legal arguments and the policy arguments, political arguments, and pretty much every argument in favor of this program would have been much stronger in the weeks and months following September 11th than they are sort of today. I was in the Justice Department on September 11th and September 12th, and I mean, it was a scary place to be. I thought for sure I was going to die that day, and I remember calling my wife to say goodbye, you know, and I mean, some scary time for everybody, and for a long time after that it was scary. And I think at that point the country would have been very receptive to almost any kind of argument. I think now it's, you know, different. Pendulum swings, it swings back. But I think both as a matter of sort of separation of powers law and as a matter of Fourth Amendment law, by analogy to the doctrine of exigent circumstances, for example, I think that there would have been a lot more leeway granted. And it's a sort of a political question, a tactical question for the government. Sort of, should they at that moment have seized the momentum from that to sort of put the broader stamp of legitimacy on this through some kind of congressional endorsement or public endorsement? You know, it's easy to second guess that now. There are lots of risks in seeking that kind of endorsement. First, you might not get it. Second, the discussion itself can blow the lid off of your program, and you know, if there's a discussion of this new secret program that allows the government to read minds from outer space or something like that, the result is that a lot of people will be putting on tinfoil hats to block it. And, you know, you don't want your source and method blown like that and then defeated by a countermeasure that suggests itself as a result of public debate. It's very serious. So I think that's the answer to Dan's second question. And finally, on the last question, I do indeed have a theory of what the government is doing and how it brought the court, brought this program to the FISA court, and I have an idea about what its application and what the court's order looks like. I've reduced that idea to writing, and I've submitted it to the Justice Department for pre-publication review. And until that pre-publication review is complete, I am unable to say anything. But the longer it takes, the more I think I must be right. But I don't know.
The reason Mr. Chris has to do that, I mean, if I wrote down on a piece of paper what I think this program is, I could tell you, because I have not had access to any information about this or any prior version of it. Mr. Chris, as the Justice Department official in charge of the FISA issues up through 2003,
yeah,
has out of a sense of prudence and responsibility wants to make sure that he is not disclosing classified information. He would speak with much more authority than I. So I'll tell you what I think the program is. No, I just kidding. I have no idea. I think Eric's speculation is right. I sort of assumed, and again, this is what I tell the students in my national security law class, but it's just guessing, that I assume that the court and I think there had been some developments in criminal law and procedure generally in which the Supreme Court, there's some Supreme Court decision, I'm not a criminal procedure expert, but some Supreme Court decision in the last couple of years which approved what's called an advance warrant, and so my assumption is that that there is some combination here of approval by the court of the algorithms or the criteria that are used to select, to screen calls or to screen emails, and then some kind of, I would imagine, some enforcement, some reporting procedure so that the court is satisfied that the criteria have been applied in a way so that only those telephone calls or emails where there is probable cause to believe that an agent of a foreign power is on one end of those calls are being surveilled. Yes, Sharon? Why don't you, could you come to the mic? Yeah, thanks. And just tell us who you are.
Hi, I'm Sharon Franklin with the Constitution Project. And there's been a fair amount of talk about how the administration has now, quote, brought the program under FISA. And I sort of feel like we don't know that that's really the case. I know that they have submitted it to the FISA, to one FISA judge. They've gotten some orders, but they haven't shared with us whether they're still getting, whether they're getting individualized orders as would be required under FISA, or what exactly they're doing. And I find it troubling. I understand that there's a lot they can't tell us and that they shouldn't tell us about their specific techniques for identifying people, but it seems to me that they should be able to tell us a little bit more about the legal theory, about whether it's individualized, about whether there's large groups, something to get the kinds of checks and balances that we really need to have operating here. And I'm just wondering if you all could speak to that.
You want to start?
I'll tell you, but then I got to kill you. what they've said, I think, is in the form of a letter that the Attorney General sent to Congress, which you can get on the Internet, and in the form of a press availability briefing conducted by two unnamed senior officials, and everybody knows who they were, but they're unnamed in the transcript. It's like that unnamed Dick Cheney thing on the airplane. It's like an unnamed official said that when I met with Hamid Karzai, I had a good time with him. Yeah. Anyway, whatever. And what they've said, though, basically, I think, is that, and I may get the wording slightly wrong, but this is the gist of it, that any surveillance activity that previously was conducted under the non-judicial version of this program is now being conducted under the authority of a FISA court order. It's true that I think they said one judge granted a series of orders, I believe it was. That's the normal way you go under FISA. You go to one judge at a time. Whether the court did some kind of, you know, informal in-bank proceeding behind that, we don't know. In the case of the FISA wall, we did actually make, I did make an argument to the full court. There's no provision of law at that time, at least, that permitted that, but they sort of decided that it would be silly to sort of have inconsistent results, you know, coming from different judges on this sort of issue that kept coming up. I don't know whether they did something similar here or not. But they have said that whatever they were doing before, it's now being done under the rubric of these FISA court orders. I guess that's about as far as I can speculate without getting into dangerous territory.
I mean, you know, we know almost nothing about what the NSA does. I mean, for years we didn't even know there was an NSA. And I think the notion that, and that's been true for Democratic, Republican administrations since the agency's founding. I mean, the notion that we're going to find out, that we should have an expectation that we're going to find out a lot about the programmatics or even the legal, of how the NSA works, I think is unrealistic. I mean, so don't be very hopeful.
Eric, you want to add anything?
Well, yeah, I think the question kind of underscores the point I was trying to make earlier, which is that I think the administration has hurt itself, politically at least, by this shroud of secrecy that they've imposed. I mean, there are basic framework questions that they could answer without getting into operational details, without getting into sources and methods. Instead, they've just thrown this blanket over everything, and it's just led to not just in the NSA case. This is true time after time in every major policy decision having to do with counterterrorism. There is an enormous amount of trust us. We can't tell you what we're doing, but you have to trust us. And unfortunately, I think they have lost a lot of credibility, and people are not willing to say anymore, do it behind closed doors, we trust you to do the right thing. And these are basic questions that it seems to me they could answer at least far more than they have so far without compromising anything.
Yeah. I just think that's an assumption, again, because we almost know nothing about the basic framework of what NSA does, and there's a reason for that. I mean, there's And so I just think that's a, I think that's a rebuttable presumption. I think the more interesting, the more relevant question is, you know, democracy is not a suicide pact. We all realize that there have to be secrets. We understand that. And then the question is who is providing, I mean, but there is transparency in democracy. And so the question is, who's doing the Bill O'Reilly? Who's looking out for us? You know, is it the Inspector General? Is it the Congress? Is it the judiciary? And so I think the more important question is, because I think the expectation is that then we're going to have very, very much other than these programs even exist, which I think is remarkable to get from the NSA. The question is are these other people doing their job? And I think that's appropriately where the debate should be, particularly in regards to the role of the Congress.
Can I just jump on?
Yeah, go ahead.
You know, I think that actually does get to a pretty fundamental question, which is how do you balance on the one hand the need for secrecy, which I think everybody acknowledges or should acknowledge, at least I believe in it, and on the other hand the idea that we are in a democracy. The way that cat was skinned in the 1970s was to create the intelligence committees of Congress, this in the wake of the sort of Church report detailing in really nauseating detail all of the tremendous abuses that the intelligence community had engaged in up until about 1976. It's not clear to me that system of sort of confined oversight is working extremely well right now. I mean, different people have different views. But it also underscores a point, I think, about oversight generally, which is it's very hard to do meaningful oversight, at least in my opinion, from Congress. It's just hard because to understand the legal and policy issues that are in play here, you really have to understand the operational reality of how the thing functions. And you can't really get that effectively, a lot of the time at least, from up on the Hill. And I think there may be a growing realization that that is the case. And so I would not be surprised if in the sort of endless push and pull between the branches in the context of the goldfish bowl that is the Washington scene and with the influence of the media and you know, sort of public policy scholars and the like, we end up moving towards a model of oversight that relies increasingly on the inspectors general. And you see the Inspector General report that recently came out on the FBI's use of the National Security Letter statutes and what a big, you know, sort of furor arose from that. The IG has the advantage of sort of being there on the ground and having access in a way that I think members of Congress don't have, and then he can sort of write it up in a report, classified and or unclassified, and sort of give some grounding to the sort of policy questions that are raised and then feed that to Congress, which will aid in oversight. So I'm not saying it's a good idea, bad idea, whatever, but I do think that sort of the evolution of this may end up pushing in that direction. I guess time will tell.
Well, of course, the other oversight, potential oversight agent is the FISA court itself, and I think Sharon Bradford's remarks indicate how the secrecy that surrounded this and the administration's assertion of authority in this and other areas has led to a level of distrust that leads people not to have the confidence that you would expect once the court says it's okay. I think there are two ways to read what the FISA court did in terms of how much confidence you have that the program is really being conducted in compliance with the FISA statute now. One is, it's pretty clear the FISA court was quite unhappy about the existence of the NSA program outside of the FISA regime. Some of the judges, or most of the judges, I guess, didn't even know about it, and one of them resigned as a result because he felt the court had been misused. And the chief judge of the court, I think, at least press reports indicate, was very unhappy that she was placed in the position of being told about the program, but told that it wasn't going to be brought within FISA. So you can, now that the program has been, quote, brought within FISA and approved by the court, there are two ways you can read it. One is that the court is so relieved and so that it's got jurisdiction over this program again that it's willing to approve almost anything. The other, and I'm kind of an optimist because I The other view is that the court would not have issued the orders, whatever they say, whatever they do, that it did, if it weren't satisfied that they comply with the letter as well as the spirit of FISA. Next question. We want to say who you are?
To do an internal investigation on the decision making and the authorization, reauthorization of the NSA surveillance program. And as the Attorney General said fairly recently in a Senate hearing, I believe it was, that was shut down because the President denied security clearances to OPR personnel, which apparently is the first time that's ever happened. At the same time, they were allowing security clearances for the criminal division to investigate Eric and the leak, and also clearances to the civil division to handle FOA requests and the civil suits, such as the ones you've alluded to. What came out in this article was that the role of Gonzalez, that when he was, as Attorney General, he recommended to the President, apparently, to use this MET technique, sort of unprecedented technique, to close down the OPR investigation. At the time, he knew that his role in the program as White House counsel would be one of the subjects of the investigation, as well as implied in the article, the role of particularly the Office of the Vice President, because there was quite a fight within the administration, which I'm sure David can tell us more about if he'd like to. And there were many people in justice who opposed the reauthorization or had serious questions about it. I mean, even apparently Ashcroft himself, Jack Goldsmith, Jim Comey, and others. And this was overridden by the recommendation of Gonzalez to reauthorize the program, despite serious objections within justice and maybe other places. And a big fight, and Addington and Libby in Cheney's office playing a major role on the other side. It appears that the Attorney General sort of shut down an investigation that would have, you know, put himself within the focus of that. But the bigger issue was the disputes and disagreements within the administration itself. It was not a clear-cut issue as to whether the program should be particularly reauthorized after it had been in existence for a period of time. So I'd be interested in your thoughts on that.
Yeah, the whole lead up to that OPR decision was an interesting time, and it got a bit of attention I think it was about 4 or 5 months. No, it was more than that. It was maybe 7 or 8 months ago when Gonzalez first revealed it before Specter's committee that the President had personally shut that down, shut down the investigation, and refused to grant security clearance. Now, even at that time, the story you're referring to last week had sort of the additional little nugget. The new part of it was the suggestion that just before that happened, Gonzalez had supposedly been told by someone, and I haven't confirm this myself, but that he could become a subject of this investigation. Well, I think that any sort of reading of the situation, it was obvious that Gonzalez was going to become a subject of this. I mean, he didn't need to be told that, I don't believe. It was clear that, I mean, I think there was a legitimate question about whether Gonzalez should have recused himself from the whole OPR investigation. Clearly, the Office of Professional Responsibility looks at ethical decisions by lawyers and whether or not they have, whether or not they've complied with various ethical restrictions. Well, clearly Gonzalez was front and center in this debate. So for him to be playing a role in advising the President to shut down an investigation obviously has the potential to cross some borders. And I think that issue is now kind of heated up again because of all the scrutiny he's under for the U.S. Attorney's thing. I think that issue has now been revived because there are questions about Gonzalez himself.
Well, I think it just underscores the point, though, that none of these mechanisms are adequate unto themselves. themselves, that congressional judiciary, the inspector general within the executive branch, and the public oversight provided by independent, nonprofit, nonpartisan groups are all part of the mix that you have to have. And the other thing I think his point is that the tension between them is healthy and productive. And I think oftentimes people say, well, that's a good thing. It should be that way. That's a sign that the system is working when there are disputes between these groups, because it shows that people aren't being complacent. Democracy is established so there is a constant war between secrecy and transparency. That's the way the system's set up, and that's the way it remains healthy. So when you have these debates, it's actually, you know, these controversies, it's actually a sign that the system is working and as it should, because it shouldn't be seamless and effortless, and there shouldn't be a new unanimity across the board. They should be in competition with each other, and the system is actually designed to put them in competition with each other. It's healthy.
Yeah, I'll just say I completely agree with that. I think that's absolutely right. It's a dynamic, not a static model. There is constant push and pull. It's, you know, three tigers locked in a cage and they fight with one another. And secrecy and democracy are in tension, and it's a healthy tension. I don't want to comment on the particulars of that story. but I will say I think the IG model, as I said before, I think may become a bigger piece of this. I don't believe it will eclipse the more traditional kinds of oversight. And there are lots of oversight mechanisms within the executive branch as well. There's the IOB, the President's Intelligence Oversight Board, and various different inspectors general and general counsels, and two intelligence committees. The Judiciary Committee is now a bigger player here. They amended FISA, for example, to require that the Attorney General keep not just the two intelligence committees, but the Senate Judiciary Committee as well, fully informed about the use of FISA, fully informed being sort of the traditional intelligence oversight standard. Why, by the way, did the House Judiciary Committee get left out of that? I don't fully understand that compromise.
Plus, they didn't raise their hand,
I guess. No, but I completely agree. I think it is a very dynamic environment of constant oversight. And the other interesting point here, I think, is the politics of all this that Eric alluded to. This story about the OPR clearance issue did hit the public several months ago and got virtually no traction. And now that it's time to pile on Judge Gonzales, because of, the other things that are going on, it's, getting a little more juice. And it just tells you, it's a cultural sort of thing. Democracy is not a system of rules, at least in the United States. It's, the whole thing plays out as a form of life, almost. So I think you see the difference in the way this story is getting traction now because of the context in which it's arising.
Thank you. Kelly.
Well, you all know who I am. I just have a question sort of coming off of what Dr. Carafano was talking about regarding, is it a zero-sum game between liberty and security? And all of you seem to agree on the premise that programs like the TSP are legal if they're given the proper oversight. If they're done properly, then there's a framework for doing things like whether it be FISA or what. But I'm kind of curious where you think that breaks down as far as, signals intelligence by its very nature is sort of a get all you can and then sort it later type of method. And historically, much of the useful intelligence they get by accident because they parse a huge amount of information, discard what they can't use and do what they can. And where does it become a zero-sum game between the needs of a collector who might not know who he's supposed to be listening to and the sort of privacy issues inherent in sort of the Fourth Amendment type of argument?
That's a big question.
I'm not sure I was necessarily asserting, you know, legality of anything, but the one sort of piece of that I break off, and David can maybe expand on this too, is that what we've seen with the TSP or the NSA program, depending on what you want to call it, is that the line that used to divide sort of international signals intelligence, where it was commonly understood that, you know, the NSA could grab everything it wanted, you know, when it didn't involve U.S. persons, the line between that and U.S. persons who were thought to have this protected status. There's a whole very, very complicated system in place of minimization to when the NSA or any other agency, the FBI, the CIA, or anyone else, is doing surveillance, electronic surveillance, signals intelligence involving U.S. persons. Before all this controversy arose, it was understood that there had to be strict and carefully tested minimization procedures to make sure that U.S. persons who were not a target of that effort were left out. You couldn't target my communications or yours or whatever. If you could target the grocer in Jakarta, but if I happened to get involved, I had to be sort of deleted from the mix. My records couldn't be detained. Now what we've seen is this blurring of this line. The protected status of U.S. persons is now kind of an amorphous thing, and it's no longer understood where the dividing line is and what the rules are, at least from where I sit. I think it's a really interesting question because it raises, I think, oftentimes I think we fail to distinguish between policy issues and technical issues. I mean, technically we can sweep up a lot more data, but technically we can also do a lot more things to minimize exposure to anonymized data. And so I think it's often the wrong question to say, should we be doing this? Is a question, the more appropriate question is how can we do this and still respect the liberties and privacies of individuals? And much often there's a technical or programmatic answer to the question that really precludes you from having to ask the legal issue of, you know, is this legitimate or not? Because you can do both. Technology is intrusive, but technology can also be protective. So, and that, of course, is one of the most frustrating things about addressing this issue, is because we can't discuss the intimate technical details, even if we knew them, which most of us don't. But I think oftentimes what we really want to be discussing is technical and programmatic decisions as opposed to policy or legal points.
Okay. Yes. This is the last question. Yeah.
My name is Hannah Powell. I'm with the Intelligence and National Security Alliance, so I should preface this by saying that I have no legal experience. But my question is in regards to these civil suits going through, particularly with the telecommunications companies, it's my understanding that there's a long history of the judiciary staying out of national security issues when they don't have the entire picture, something like ruling CIA or Sims v. CIA, et cetera, that when the judiciary doesn't have the entire picture of what's going on, they back off, saying, we don't know what's going on, so we can't rule on this issue. So I'm curious as to why in the courts now they seem to be allowing these cases to go forward, even though the executive has stepped in and said, this is an issue of state secrets, this is something that you don't have the whole picture of, so please don't rule on this, because allowing the case to continue will, in effect, release sources and methods, and reduce our ability to provide for national security.
The two reasons, I guess, or at least two of the reasons that the judiciary is sometimes a little reluctant to get into these things are, first, state secrets doctrine, which is a legal doctrine that Professor Marcus talked about earlier. That doctrine is, I think, being pressed here, and we'll see how far it goes and if it has a stopping point or some kind of boundary doctrine. But the gist of it is that if a lawsuit requires the disclosure of classified information in order to be resolved, the suit must be dismissed. The second reason, I think, or a second reason that courts tend to want to sort of back off is the institutional competence reason, which is that a lot of these issues involve delicate questions of foreign policy that the judiciary just doesn't feel like it knows enough to resolve, and they want to leave it to the experts in the executive branch. Having said that, I mean, I think there are a number of cases from the past in which the courts have avoided questions, and there are a number where they have tackled the question. The Keith case from the 1970s involved the constitutional validity of domestic security surveillance without a warrant and went to the Supreme Court. Mitchell versus Forsyth, a case involving domestic or perhaps in foreign intelligence surveillance, went to the Supreme Court in the posture of a sort of a civil rights type complaint. So there are some where they're willing to do it. I think concretely with respect to the NSA surveillance program, for example, I felt qualified to write and opine on the validity of the statutory arguments that the administration had advanced in support of the program, even without the facts. And I felt I could do that. The administration felt it could say some things about them in a white paper, and that's in the record. I did not feel, however, that I could answer the constitutional questions without the facts. So there is an example of sort of half a loaf. And I think that's just the reality of that. That's sort of, I think, where the line ends up being drawn.
But let me just add one thing, which is I think, and the decision, not so much the Michigan decision, which held the program unconstitutional and rejected the state secrets argument or said it wasn't necessary to disclose state secrets to decide the case, but there's another preliminary decision by a district judge in San Francisco in the lawsuit against the phone companies in which the government has intervened. And I think where you have, you're right in, I think, in perceiving a change in the attitude of the courts. I think in the face of the sweeping assertions of executive authority that this administration has made and the potential impact of something like the NSA surveillance program on constitutional rights of Americans, that the courts are going to be very reluctant to indulge the state secrets doctrine as a basis for cutting off the lawsuit completely. And so you see the judges straining, the judge in San Francisco straining to say, I'm going to reject the state secrets argument here, not because I'm going to require the disclosure of state secrets. I wouldn't do that. But I think we know enough about these programs to adjudicate their constitutionality without requiring the disclosure of state secrets. And I think the same phenomenon is at work there as we've seen in the Supreme Court in its remarkable willingness to take on and to strike down actions of the administration in the war on terror, which a lot of people thought they wouldn't be willing to do in cases like Hamdi and Rasool and Hamdan. So I do think you're right in perceiving a change, but it's not going to happen. It's not going to mean that the courts are suddenly going to start requiring disclosure of state secrets. They're going to find a way to decide these important questions if they think they need to without requiring disclosure of state secrets. Okay, well, thank you all very much, and thanks again to our panelists for a terrific discussion.